it's always a real pleasure for me to give him an introduction because he, you know, I interview lots of different people on these types of calls, but Paul is my actual principal instructor in homeopathy, and he's the person who really gave me the foundation and the excitement to continue in my study and practice. Paul is the author of a number of different books, the very famous Homeopathic Treatment of Children, Pediatric Constitutional Types. He is also the author of a book called Stramonium, and he's also the author of two newer titles on provings, both of which are quite excellent. And if you haven't had a chance to look at those books, I know they're probably not as much circulated in the community as his two previous books, but they are both very, very excellent works. He's also the producer and writer for the Herskew Letter, which is an excellent kind of home study course that you can basically kind of learn his approach through by understanding its development in the history of homeopathy with specific case examples and pedagogical exercises, and it's an amazing, amazing way to really begin to further understand the cycles and segments model. Paul is also runs a school out of Massachusetts called the New England School of Homeopathy. He's one of the most highly regarded educators and practitioners in the world. He travels all over Europe and the United States teaching, and very highly and well regarded. He's also going to be starting a new course in Portland, Oregon, and that's going to start in January. The dates are January 20th through the 22nd. That's 2006. And that's going to be a three-year program?
It's going to be a two-year.
Two-year program. And this is basically the advanced version of the program that I took. So if anybody wants to really get a tremendous foundation on the practice of homeopathy, one that will really create increased consistency and successful practice, I can't recommend this program highly enough. If you want more information about the program, you can contact Kim. It's a different Kim, not me. Kim or Amy at 413-256-5949. That's 413-256-5949. Or they can email Nesh. That's N-E-S-H, Nancy Edward Sam Harry, Nesh, at Nesh, N-E-S-H again, .com. And also, Dr. Herskew will be teaching a Nesh course in Florida, and that's beginning December 9th through the 11th of 2005. And again, same contact information. If you want more info about that, you can contact Kim or Amy at 413-256-5949, or you can email them at Nesh@Nesh.com. The reason I had asked Paul to do another one of these calls after he has already done so many with us is because of an experience I had recently at a seminar of his in Southern California, where I've had the opportunity to witness him demonstrating the Herskew cycle and segments model with a live case. And even though I've been familiar with Paul's work for years now and have been a very strong advocate and proponent of his work, I really believe it's the most advanced model we have in homeopathy. Even though all of those things are true, I don't think I fully grasped how amazing this model is for creating a consistently successful practice. And I only really got a breath of that tremendous insight of this approach by watching Paul demonstrate it in a live case taken at a seminar. And it really re-inspired me to want to make sure that everybody who's involved in homeopathy is aware of this tremendous contribution that Paul has made to the art and science of homeopathy. So without further ado, Paul, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you again for taking the time out to join us for one of these calls.
Well, thank you for those kind words.
Well, they're truly heartfelt, and I really believe them wholeheartedly. So anyway, Paul, I thought perhaps you could start by kind of giving us a sense of how you developed the cycles and segments approach. I mean, how did this come to you? I know intuitively you were kind of practicing this way already, but how did you develop the language to actually describe this model?
Great. Well, you know, that's a really good question in terms of language, because to a certain extent, language and thought go hand in hand. Since the beginning of my practice in homeopathy, I had been practicing something along this line and writing about this along this line. In fact, my first articles in homeopathy in 86 were about this. And what it comes down to is this sort of dynamic tension which exists in homeopathy really from the beginning of homeopathy, which we can see in Hahnemann's writing, in that on the one hand, a fair amount of the organon is about and the homeopathic philosophy, therefore, is treating the individual, treating the whole, treating the person who is sick, and talking about why and why people get sick and so on. And then on the other side, you have the actual tools of homeopathy, the materia medica, the repertory, the therapeutic books, and so on, that are actually mostly not about the whole individual, but mostly about the pieces of the individual. These are the symptoms of the nose, these are the symptoms of the eyes, these are the symptoms of the head, and so forth. And that dynamic tension of how do you see the whole versus all of the little pieces, that's something that has, I believe the word is plague, homeopathy from the beginning, because how each homeopath defines that relationship, that's to the extent that their successes and failures will exist. Because our philosophy really is about treating the whole human being, and yet what we use, a repertory talks about a symptom, the materia medica lists one symptom after another. So, dissatisfied with that dichotomy, I try to find a language that bridges the two. And the best way to find that language is to just read everything that's come before you. Reading through, from the first Materia Medicas onward, from the first philosophical books onward. And what I notice is really just a general progression in what I would call the classic writers of starting off with where we needed to get a pure Materia Medica, of paying attention, strictly speaking, to every individual symptom that would develop, and saying that in the Materia Medica, saying, well, the Materia Medica Pura, for example, this remedy, this substance, when given to a healthy person in a sufficient quantity, causes this exact symptom. So paying attention to those kinds of symptoms, then shifting maybe 20, 30 years later to the next level of books, to, let's say, Bonninghausen's books, where Bonninghausen tries to meld the philosophy and the practical tools together and saying, well, why don't we take a bunch of those symptoms and combine them in some fashion and see if we can get to something that's a little bit of a higher truth, to Haring, to Kent, who kept on progressing in this line, to, the more modern writers like Vifokas, who would then take a lot of the symptoms and say all these symptoms belong to this one idea or this one, the essence is the word he would use. So what I notice is there's a kind of a tradition in our profession of trying to meld these disparate, discordant, points of view. And so what I did is, it actually came very naturally to me. I had a patient that, and I've written about this and spoken about this, I had a patient who was in the middle of a miscarriage, and the miscarriage began when she washed her face, and as soon as the water hit her face, she started to bleed from the uterus. And I know that symptom is a classic kind of symptom for the remedy Arnica. And in asking her a bunch of different questions, I realized that it was actually an Arnica situation she was in. Gave her Arnica, and miscarriage stopped. She had a nice, healthy child. End of the story for her. But for me, it was interesting because I came to the question of, do I pay attention to the actual symptom, the real actual symptom, which is nosebleed from washing the face, or do I in some way generalize that that symptom to bleeding from other places upon washing the face. And that level of generalization, I think I can honestly say, saved that pregnancy and that child. And going along the same line, I then treated several children that would have either a very difficult childbirth or had some sort of trouble at birth, and then the child looked okay, but as soon as they were put in a bath to be washed, they would have a seizure. And then it turned out they had a bleed in the brain and so on. And so the question again, there is no rubric, miscarriage from washing, there is no symptom, miscarriage washing the face. There is no symptom of a child having a stroke from bathing. But there is the inkling of what that symptom is really about from the keynote of Arnica, washing the face. And so that, and then I wrote about that, talking about how one may generalize a symptom, the right way of generalizing it, the wrong way of generalizing it, and so on. And what I believe I was doing is following the very well-paved road that from Hahnemann onwards, good homeopaths have traveled. What was interesting, though, is when you get to a certain level of understanding of the remedy, all of a sudden, a lot of the symptoms I'd say almost all the symptoms are predicted. You can understand a remedy in a few words, and from those words, and understand why the symptoms developed in the first place, understand why the patient develops a sequence of symptoms, and be actually able to predict it to the point that you can get to asking patients, you know, about symptoms and saying, well, if this is correct, you should have such and such a symptom, and in fact they do. So that level of generalization, of correct generalization, I think has led to a bunch of different benefits. The biggest one, I'd say, is realizing that all remedies have actually, even though they have thousands of symptoms or tens of thousands of symptoms, that all those symptoms are actually representative of only a few ideas. And once you get it to that level, then you get all kinds of benefits that one couldn't see before. Chief amongst them is you can start to see a relationship of one idea to another idea, one what I would call a segment or a piece of the whole to another segment, and just see how when one develops one of these segments, for example, what's a good example? Let's say a remedy that has many, many discharges, arsenicum, sulfur, veratrum, phosphorus, it doesn't actually matter which of those remedies, how you can take a lot of those discharges and combine them into one packet, in a way. One general idea. And then be able to predict that in various places of the body, they would have this discharge and that discharge and so on. And then once you see those discharges, then see that the discharges naturally lead to a drying effect or a weakening effect, and you'll be able to find hundreds and hundreds of symptoms in each of those remedies that are exemplify that. And then the question is, what does the person needing that remedy do to get rid of that dryness, to fix that dryness, or to fix that weakness? And by asking those questions, you can start to see a third segment, a fourth segment, a fifth segment, and so forth, until finally you come to a point where the segment you are working on naturally leads to the first segment, naturally leads to the discharges, for example, therefore making a cycle. Once I got to that, which was a really interesting thing, because all of a sudden, all the bits of homeopathy, all the kind of rules and concepts of homeopathy actually had a reason for it. For example, what's a good example? We say in homeopathy that if you have a lot of symptoms in a case, but you don't have any modalities, then you don't have a full case. That the most important symptoms that you can have in a interview is the modalities. In other words, what makes the complaint better or worse. Well, that idea is predicated upon, if you think about it, on the relationship of one set of symptoms leading to the other set of symptoms, which then lead to the next set of symptoms. In other words, this thing creates the problem. This thing, number one, the symptoms in number one, creates the real problem, the symptoms in number two, and because of those symptoms, they then have to do something to feel better, the symptoms in number three. So all of a sudden, we realize, oh, there is a logical reason why modalities are important, and not just why they're important, but how they fit into a larger scheme. Another great example is Herring's Law, that many times, if you look very carefully, you'll find that as a patient is getting sicker, they are losing some set of symptoms and having a new set of symptoms, but those new set of symptoms are within the same segment. In other words, they've lost the perspiration and now they have the diarrhea, or they've lost the diarrhea and now they have the hemorrhage. So they're switching from one discharge to another. They used to have irritable colon, now they have irritable lungs, and so on. So we start to see how a lot of the kind of disparate individual rules that are, quote, supposed to be important, really are important. In other words, that kind of a simple model could put together a lot of the history of homeopathy, which is the kind of neat thing about model making, that a good model should be able to, A, incorporate everything that came beforehand, and B, be able to be a better predictor of future events. So I think we actually have the language for that now. And, we're far from being done. There's a lot that has to be done. But I think we're on our way.
No, Paul, I know for myself, whenever, because I do go around and I present your model to lots of different people, and one of the things that people are always most amazed by is the change in the way that they study Materia Medica. That, you know, once you understand your model, you don't have to memorize a list of symptoms, that you really can understand the process underneath the remedy itself. And I know for a lot of people this is like a relief for them, because now they can actually begin to understand the remedies in a much more profound and deeper way. And I know that really makes quite a bit of a difference.
Right.
You know, I'm sorry, did you want to comment on that before?
That it's not about memorizing symptoms. It's that the symptoms are actually there for a purpose. And if you can understand that purpose, then you can actually understand the process of the disease that's happening to that patient, and you can match that to a similar kind of process that you've developed from a good read of the Materia Medica. A good read of the Materia Medica should lead to the underlying premise of what that remedy is about, and should be able to predict what that remedy would do as in babies or in 95-year-olds, because it's the same underlying process for every individual that would need that remedy.
Sure.
So it's one of the main problems in the reading of Materia Medica now is that people are trying to understand a static picture rather than an underlying process.
Mm. You know, Paul, I need to ask this, even though, because it's something I've heard from a lot of people, which is, you know, oh, Paul Hirst, you've come out with this new approach, and it's one of many different approaches that are out there. And I always try to communicate to people that that's not really what this is, that it's really, really the evolution of the whole movement of the history of homeopathy, if you look at it. But I thought maybe you could just comment on that, because I do hear it a lot, you know, people saying that, oh, this is just Paul's new way of dealing with, you know, homeopathy, and there's 25 other ways of doing it. And can you comment on that at all? Or I don't mean to put you in a difficult position, but I hear it.
It is true. There are probably 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 different ways of handling the homeopathic prescription. It's just a question of, you know, what works best, and if the way that it works well in your hands, well, I mean, that's great, and you really shouldn't change what you're doing. But for me, you know, that's not what I see. I mean, the bottom line is it's just not what I see. If homeopathy was doing what it's supposed to be doing, we would be a paradigm. We would be the paradigm of medicine, not on the fringe of medicine. Homeopathy would be growing instead of, you know, in it diminishing at this point. And studies would show positive effect one after another instead of negative effects. So if we can say that things are not going well in general in the homeopathic community, not that people don't get better. I mean, people get better in every practice, but do the majority of the people that one sees that sees a general homeopath improve to the level that we read in what's expected, for instance, in the Organon? I think, you know, an honest appraisal would be no. So that means that there's something, again, discordant between the philosophy and what people get as results. And I think it's not just something I work on as a whim. This is, you know, I think it works well. It really does make sense.
Yeah. Well, I totally agree with you, Paul, and I've known you for a long time, and I've always considered you to be a person, a man of very high integrity. So, you know, for me, when you first approached me and shared this approach, you know, you remember my initial reaction was one of resistance, because I thought, you know, why do you need to come up with this whole new way of doing homeopathy? But, you know, it was because of my respect for you that I had to keep going back and seriously considering what you were saying to me. And when I did really seriously consider it and I applied it to my own cases, I saw that it was 100% true, that all of my cases could be described as a process in time, as a movement from one state to another. And it really blew me away, I have to say, so I can understand a little bit of people's resistance to it. I guess, let me ask you a very forthright question. What have you found to be your own success in practice and also the success of your students? Are your students, when they go to your school and they study with you, are they able to go out and have a very high level of consistent success in their practice?
I'd say they do pretty well.
Yeah.
And it really is a question of, that there's a didactic part to education and then there's the practice part of education. And putting those that put in what we talk about in class in practice seem to do pretty well. And more than seem to do pretty well, because we meet every 2 months. They come back and they say, oh my God, I saw exactly what we were talking about. There's a woman in a class that I'm teaching just now who is a vet, and we were talking about the kind of the internal workings of this remedy, Crotalus horridus. And she said, oh my God, this is the horse that I'm treating right now. And this horse was basically getting ready to be euthanized, you know, this beautiful racehorse, because of these this thing called DIC, and you know, she gave the remedy, and horse is doing great. Horse is doing great, and it was just exactly what we were talking about.
Hmm.
You know, just right down the line, and that pretty much happens regularly.
Hmm.
You know, it really is true that there's a lot of different philosophies out there, and you know, I in some respects I feel bad for the aspiring homeopath or the homeopath that's working, because having been in this profession for as long as I have, I see just the massive confusion. I mean, just I don't know, I don't have any other word for it.
Mm.
And
I see that too.
You know, and you, I, for me, what's really sad is there's a lot of really, really smart people that come into homeopathy. They look at it, they test it, and then they leave. And it's sad to me because, you know, they just didn't have a good approach, or they didn't have a consistent approach, or they didn't have something that made sense. You know, they have a philosophy class where they talk about this beautiful thing that Hahnemann, this and that, and then they come to the practical application, and the person prescribes based on this keynote, or based on this emotional symptom, or based on this, you know, general symptom, and so on. It doesn't; those things don't match. They don't jive.
Hmm.
The way they repertorize one case winds up being different than the way they have to repertorize another case, and you know, the third case, and so on. That's not a science,
right?
You know, and I feel bad about that.
Right.
But I understand that it's a kind of everybody's on this journey, and you know, they'll take what they feel works for them, and hopefully what they pick does work for them. In my practice, I haven't found that that's true for a lot of homeopaths. They go to things and they try it, and then they leave homeopathy, and that's sad to me. So I think having a kind of a method that actually seems to work for, you know, seems to explain on and predict patients' diseases, at the very least, that would be, if that's the only thing people did, that would be great. If that's the only thing they got from my method, that would be great. That would be like a major leap forward for them.
Mm-hmm.
Can I give you an example?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I'm teaching in Switzerland, and this woman comes in with multiple sclerosis, and she describes, I asked her a couple of symptoms about, before the multiple sclerosis, I asked her about just her urination, her digestion, just some other non-multiple sclerosis kinds of symptoms, having nothing to do with MS. Then I asked her to leave temporarily, and then I asked the participants in the class, if this method was correct, what do you think her emotional state will be? What do you think she will tell us of her emotional state? And then everybody ventured, you know, multiple guesses. And then I asked, and what do you think her symptoms of the multiple sclerosis will be? And then everybody ventured a bunch of different guesses. And then the patient came back, and we asked about the emotions, and they were exactly what people guessed. And then I asked about the multiple sclerosis, and they were exactly the symptoms that people guessed. That's a science. Those people,
sure,
who've been studying together for, you know, 6-8 years, and those people just have been following this for to the point where, you know, we can predict the symptoms that the person is going to be saying, and therefore predict the symptoms that are going to be important in the analysis and the repertorization and so on. That, I think, is, well, that's pretty cool.
It certainly is.
You know, and we do that over and over and over.
Hmm.
And so,
Paul, could you give us an example
if
of
that? If that's the only thing they got from this method, I think that by itself would be useful because then they will, they can use whatever other method they choose to find a remedy, but at least they'll know what needs to be fixed.
Well, that's obviously
in
very important.
In a predictable fashion.
Right, right. Paul, could you describe some remedy from the cycles and segments perspective? Like, just give us a quick, you know, rundown of what, because a lot of people probably don't aren't familiar with, you know, how a remedy is described as a process. could you do a small remedy for us? I know it's hard in a short period of time, but maybe an abbreviated summary version?
Jeez. I don't know if what you get from that.
How about arnica? You mentioned arnica. How about arnica?
Okay, arnica. That's smallish enough because we don't actually have to look at any symptoms and it just sort of work off our knowledge. You know, we don't have to actually open up a materia medica for this. So if you take arnica, you have we have the kind of key features of, you know, shock, injuries, and so on. And then the question comes, when do you give arnica, and when do you give helleborus, or when do you give opium, or when do you give natrium sulfuricum, or when do you give hypericum, and so on. And there are actually dozens of remedies that could be used in a trauma. So when is it that somebody would actually need arnica? And if you take all the symptoms of arnica, all of them, they come to the following few points. So number one is a trauma of various sorts. That's the trauma could be, you know, this kind of injury, a birth injury, some kind of trauma. And you look at the materia medica and you can take the hundreds of symptoms that would fit under trauma and throw them all under the same grouping. The effect of the trauma on arnica patients is the second point. That would be leaving the body. They leave the body either going into a coma, as in leaving the body, or the fluids leaving where they belong, as in the blood vessels rupturing and the blood leaving, but somehow leaving the body, a shock state. And right there, it's enough to be able to tell the difference already between a remedy like arnica and a remedy like helleborus or a remedy like opium, because the primary effect of the first segment right after the trauma is not going to be shock for opium. It's going to be a different thing. It's not going to be shock for helleborus. It'll be something else. So all the different examples of leaving the body, of losing consciousness, would fit into that second segment. The third segment is they come back, and when they come back, they don't come back all the way. So they come back, and they're feeling the pains, the aching and soreness and, you know, pain here and pain there, lots and lots of different pains. Lots of different sensations in the body, but they don't come back all the way. That's a key feature to them. The fourth point is because of the pain, they have an aversion touch. You know, as we know, the bruised shoulder that hurts from touch, or the bruised calf that hurts from touch, and so on. But what would be this, I ask, as we go through this description, I'll ask the participants in the class, what would be the emotional correspondent to aversion touch or aggravation from touch? What's the emotional aspect of it? Yep.
Aversion constellation?
Yeah. So if that's true, if this idea is true, then the person would be averse to constellation. Then you look up aversion constellation, you find arnica there. But all of a sudden, it's not like a memorizing sort of thing. It makes sense that it's part of the same kind of pattern that they're going through. So aversion touch mentally, aversion touch emotionally, aversion touch physically. The fifth point is that because of the aversion touch, they become independent. They don't want help. And we have that kind of keynote of, you know, says he's well, sends the doctor home, and so on. But the actual arnica patient, you know, the chronic arnica patient, the arnica patient that's been in the arnica state for 20, 30 years, very independent, self-working kind of people, not wanting any assistance, getting angry if you contradict them, getting angry if you interfere with them, just wanting to do things themselves and so on, because, just going backwards, because they don't want touch, because touch hurts them, because they're in all this pain that they experience from that shock. And the effect of the work, the next point is because they are not all the way there, they bump into things, they hit things to get into the next accident, and the cycle just repeats itself. And so any of you that have been in an arnica, a true arnica acute state, remember that after the injury, and you thought you were okay and everything was okay because you were in a shock state and you didn't want somebody to help you, there's an excellent chance that you bumped into things and you dropped things and so on. And those people that have been in an arnica chronic state for 10 years, 20 years, remember that the second car accident was that much easier after the first car accident because you weren't all the way there. And if you're a person that is treating somebody that had a stroke 10 years ago and they come and now they're somewhat back, they're independent and so on, but they don't want help, but they also don't have speech. They're not all the way back. So this is like a very quick caricature of what the remedy is about, but all of a sudden we can see why somebody that needs arnica could, in these, you know, just this handful of ideas, you can capture several thousand symptoms and categorize them each in their own place. And you can understand, one could understand why an arnica patient, a patient that needs arnica chronically, will then get injured again and again. It all of a sudden, we start to see that the trauma is not a one-off event in the arnica patient. The trauma is an ongoing event. And that I'd say another one of the benefits of this method is that a lot of times in the history of homeopathy, it's always been a question of ailments from. How do we use ailments from? Is it sometimes important? Is it always important? Is it eliminating kind of symptom? How do we use it? And we'll find cases where, and historically, we'll find cases where people say, well, I used ailments from in this case because of such and such, but in this other case, even though they had exactly the same event happen, we're not going to use ailments from. And the question has always been, well, how do you use it? When do you use it? Everybody that's been in a trauma, do you use ailments from injury? And there's never actually been an answer to that, but in this model, there really is an answer to it, in that if, as we went through the cycle, the injury is the trauma is an ongoing event. It's not something that happened just in a car accident 2 years ago, 2 weeks ago, or the stroke that happened 2 weeks ago. It's an ongoing event, which means that with any kind of stimuli, they will be traumatized by. All kinds of stimuli will hurt them. You with me?
Totally, yeah.
So if you have another patient who says, two people in the car, They're both in the same accident. They both hit their head. They both are bleeding. They both go into shock, and then they come out of it. Patient number one, touch aggravates. Noise aggravates. Consolation aggravates. They want to do things themselves. They bump into things. They this thing hurts them, that thing hurts them, and so on. Patient number two, same accident, same trauma, same everything. Now every little thing that happens to them, every little stimuli, scares them. They get a fright from noise. They get a fright from touch. They get a fright from light, and so on. So for that person, even though they were traumatized, for them, it's actually ailments from fright. It's not ailments from injury. And so, and then we can predict, well, this is true. Every single time they have a kind of a stress, they will experience it as a frightening stress. As opposed to the other person, every time they experience something, it will be an injury to them. So, as I said, this model really does kind of put together the best of what we have known as classical homeopathy in a logical way, in a way that not just makes sense from the kind of pretty sitting there at home thinking about, but makes sense from the pathologic point of view, but then really pans out in the clinic where you can see this again and again and again. Just pan out. Just predict it again and again. There's a lot more to go. There's materia medica that have to be written. There's repertories that have to be written. Most importantly, there's trying to figure out how to deal with the increasing complexity of human pathology. But again and again, we've found that we have been able to use this model, and which is a nice point of model making. A good model should predict things that haven't really been thought about before. And so when the question came to provings, for example, we conducted four provings, and then we conducted proving and another reproving and reproving and reproving, and then we did two provings on a different remedy. Six times we were able to tell the difference between somebody that got the remedy and somebody that got placebo. That's
unusual, isn't it, Paul?
Time in homeopathic history, because every time they do studies, every time our colleagues, our homeopathic brethren try to do studies to tell the difference between placebo and verum in a homeopathic proving, they can never tell. But we were able to tell it again and again and again. And so I think it's yet again a kind of a vindication, but it also shows us that a good model can kind of point us towards clarifying the problems that we have in homeopathy and perhaps get better results.
You know, Paul, I've always loved the elegance of the cycles and segments model. And I think from people who are listening on, they can really appreciate that. But I thought perhaps you could just briefly touch upon the practical value in terms of repertorization, because I know that's one area that creates a lot of confusion for people in the community. And I've always felt that your model totally eliminates most of the problems of repertorization. Could you just quickly comment on that?
Yeah. We developed the materia medica with tens and then hundreds and then thousands of remedies. It became impractical to memorize all the symptoms of all the remedies, and we needed a quick access point to it. And so we developed a kind of a database that in the last 20 years has become digitalized, but it's basically been a database all along of retrieving the symptoms. The problem has been that no method of repertorization has consistently led to the right remedy, which has to do with what I was talking about before, that the repertory mimics the error in the Materia Medica, which is that we are looking at individual symptoms rather than the individual. We're looking at the pieces rather than the whole that homeopathy promises us philosophically. And so we need a sort of a method of repertorization that will lead us more predictably to the right remedy, and that would lead us, that we can use each and every time, the same method of repertorization, each and every time, that would lead us to a small group of remedies that would then, the remedy we want would be one of those remedies. So what I have done is, in the current versions of the repertories that we have, the best way to use that tool is to mirror the cyclone segment concept in the repertory. And the way to do that is to grab the symptoms that mean exactly the same thing. And since they mean exactly the same thing, combine them into one larger rubric. And that larger rubric would then encompass that idea, that segment. And with that segment behind, we can then go to ask, what does this segment lead to? That would give us a group of rubrics that we would combine to form a second segment. Where does this segment come from? That would lead us to a group of rubrics that show us a third segment, and so on, until we realize that all of a sudden, the last segment that we created by combining these rubrics lead us right back to the first segment. And then the case is actually complete. Because up to then, it's always been a question of, well, how do you repertorize? Some people repertorize using just the physical generals. But then, which of the physical generals are you going to use? You know, everybody has dozens of physical generals, and some of them are going to matter to the case, and some of them aren't. And which of the keynotes are you going to use? Some of them matter to the case, and some of them don't. Which are the mentals and emotionals? Same thing. It's always been a question of what should you pay attention to? And the best way to answer that is that it has to somehow be part of the cycle. If it's not part of the cycle, those symptoms, while they may be important at some point, they're not important at this point because they're not feeding within this pattern. You've taken care of quite a few problems. You've taken care of the inaccuracies of the repertory, of the incompleteness of the repertories, of the mistakes in the repertories, of the rubrics that are kind of the same, but not really. You've taken care of duplicating remedies. In other words, if you combine anxiety about health and hypochondriasis, or if you combine reproaches himself and anxiety about crime, if you combine those into one, you made a larger rubric that means exactly the same thing, instead of running it separately, in which case you would be duplicating essentially the larger remedies in the Materia Medica, in the repertory, and kind of losing the smaller remedies. So this method actually helps to equalize the playing field, and I'd say that the difficulty of many homeopaths that don't actually have a good sense of the repertory, or that it takes them so many years to learn the repertory, you can pretty much within a year make them very, very facile with the tool, and pretty useful in their practice. And the remedy that come out will have the remedy that's necessary at the end of it. And you can use this method. I know I'm being very quick in overviewing it, but
this
method would work with pretty much every single patient. We've demonstrated that over and over.
Well, Paul, I have a lot more questions I'd love to ask, but I see that our time is running short, so I'm going to give other people an opportunity. Before I unmute the lines and let people ask their own questions, let me just remind them that Dr. Paul Herskew and his wife, Amy Rothenberg, are going to be starting a 2-year course on the West Coast in Portland, Oregon, and classes are scheduled to begin on January 20th through the 22nd, 2006. If anybody wants more information about that course, which I cannot recommend highly enough, they can contact Kim or Amy at 413-256-5949. That's 413-256-5949. Or they can email Nesh, N-E-S-H, at Nesh, N-E-S-H, .com. Or they can simply go to the Nesh website, which is www.nesh.com. Also, Dr. Herskew is going to be starting a course in Florida. Where in Florida is that, Paul?
It's just north of Fort Myers.
Okay, north of Fort Myers. So it's kind of in the center of the state, I guess.
Yep.
That'll be starting December 9th through the 11th of 2005. And again, if they want information for that, they can contact Kim or Amy at 413-256-5949, or they can email at nesh@nesh.com. Also, if you want...
I'm sorry. I was just going to say that the Florida course is going to have more veterinary homeopathy than I've tended to teach. I usually teach vets in every one of my classes, but this time I usually take a lot of cases because it's nice to exemplify the method because you don't have to deal with a lot of, they either get better or they don't.
Right.
And it's very nice to demonstrate the tools and then use the same exact tools in babies that are pre-verbal and then children that are not verbal or suffering from autism or people that are in a coma or unconscious and just sort of build up. So we can, I'm excited about that one.
Okay, that's great. So to reiterate, the course in Florida is going to focus not exclusively but more on veterinary type of information.
Right.
And also just wanted to remind everybody, if you haven't subscribed to the Herskew Letter, it really is well worth worth getting. I've been getting them for years now, and they're always just really fascinating and really very informative, and it's really a tremendous home study course, probably one of the best that's out there. And again, you can find out more information about that by going to their website or corresponding to them at Nesh and Nesh.com. So, Paul, thank you again. Let me open it up to the general audience. One second. Somebody have a question they'd like to ask Dr. Herskew?
I have a question. It's Carol from Canada. I'm a team administrator for HPathy on the Internet. It's one of the biggest homeopathic websites. I'd like to do a short review on this session tonight, if I have permission.
Paul?
Sure.
That's okay.
That's okay with me.
Hello?
Would there be a link to the, we'll be posting this interview up on our website. Will you link to that?
I certainly will. Okay.
Okay, great. Yeah, by all means then, go ahead and do it.
Okay, good.
Great.
Thanks. And one other question. A person, before they got really ill with multiple sclerosis, the main feeling that they felt was, it's okay, I'm not going to hurt anymore. And based on that, I used the remedy Natrum Myrrh. Does that make sense?
Well, I could see how it might, but I guess one of the biggest points that I make by using this model is symptoms are all interdependent and they're context dependent. So in reality, what people find out, especially since a lot of the repertories are digitalized, is that every remedy can be in every symptom. It's the reason behind the symptom that matters. And so you can say there are hundreds of remedies that will say, it's okay, that way I won't be in pain anymore. It's the reason behind it that matters. And by the reason behind that and the reason behind that, and pretty soon you have a cycle. And you can understand why it is that they would say that statement. Because, yeah, anyway. Of course, I could spend an hour on that.
Okay, hold on.
In a couple of them. Are you finished with that one?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah.
Ask the question.
Hi, this is Margaret from Beacon. There's two of them. I would like to know what the questions you ask for the four segments, and could you explain how the fourth goes back to the first? And then the second question I have, for each segment when you're repertorizing, do you choose the remedy that gets the highest repertorization? I don't understand the actual mechanics of the process, or do you meld them? I don't understand how, if you divide them for each one, then how you go about then picking, do you pick one from each segment and then repertorize that, those four, or how do you actually, what is the mechanics of it, I guess?
I'll take the first one first.
Okay, thanks.
If you have a complaint, let's say the complaint is epilepsy, then you can take all the symptoms of the seizure itself. In other words, this limb jerking like this, this limb jerking like that, this, the head going in this direction, the eyes going in that direction, and so on. You could combine all of those symptoms into one segment. Then the question would be, what precipitates that particular seizure? And all the answers to that, you'll start to see a common idea behind that. That would be the segment that comes beforehand. So for example, fright, or another patient, and they'll have different examples of that, or unconsciousness, and they'll have different examples of that. For instance, when I go to sleep, when I am faint, when I'm dehydrated, when I, if I smoke marijuana, what have you, as they're losing consciousness, as they're letting a tight grip on their world, that's when the seizure comes up, and you'd be able to combine all of those together in one, the segment that precipitates the seizure. Then the next question would be, after the seizure, what happens? What do they have to do? And those answers would lead to the third. And then what happens after they do that thing would lead to the fourth, and so on. It has a very natural progression. There's nothing bizarre about it. Once you understand the concept, it flows very, very naturally. But there are more than four segments. There'll be five, there'll be six segments. You just follow the process until the next segment they'll say is, and then I fall asleep, or then I lose consciousness. For example, the segment before that might have been jogging or staying up all night, exerting themselves in some fashion, and then afterwards they have to relax and they have to let go and they have to go to sleep, and then the seizure comes on. So the cycle completes and then repeats itself over and over again. In terms of the actual mechanics of it, when you combine those like symptoms, they become one symptom. So all the eyes moving in this direction, the hand moving in that direction, and so forth, all of those actually become one rubric. Then the second segment becomes one rubric. Then the third segment, all those symptoms become one rubric. When you're done with those six rubrics, those six mega rubrics, you find which remedies come through, which are the remedies that are found in segment one, plus segment two, plus segment three, plus segment four, plus five and six. And you'll find a handful. You'll find four, five, six remedies. And the remedy you want will be one of those remedies. There's a finite number. There'll be, you know, a handful of remedies. And it's the first time in homeopathy that you can say there's a finite number. because every other method of repertorization has an infinite number. There's the most likely all the way to the 500th remedy that repertorizes. But in this situation, you really are looking at a finite number, and then you look between those to find the correct remedy.
Paul, let me just add that for the person who asked that question, it's very difficult to visualize this without actually doing it yourself or, you know, going through one of the Hirschke letters. So I do want to suggest that you either go and you study, take some classes with Paul, or you get his Hirschke letter, because just to hear it on the phone like this is a little bit difficult to grasp it.
Yep.
But once you've seen it a few times, it becomes really obvious and very simple, and it totally makes sense once you get to see it firsthand. So let me go ahead. I think we have time for one more question, so let me just unmute the line. One last question.
Referred to in the Radar 9.
Say that again?
Is Radar 9 referring to cycles and segments?
Well, there is a part of the Radar program that does contain the Hirschke module, which does really allow you to use the cycles and segments approach to service. Is that your question?
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
Can I ask one question?
Yes, go ahead, Krishna. Last question.
Yes, yes. You know, Paul, I read your book of Stramonium. It was so interesting that you have it in one side and calc, and then going to Stramonium or Alzheimer's or that. Actually, I had my grandchild and who was pulsatilla type, but there, then she started showing manifestation of that ghost and seeing images, and then while she's awake, like people, and then I gave Stramonium, and what happened that she did not have, she was very susceptible to colds and all that. For 1 year, she never had colds and all. But then following that, Stramonium did not do anything. And just I said, where she's gone now from that to that layer. And I really, it fascinated me, that book, Stramonium. And I was thinking, oh, I can learn quite a bit. But then you lose that track because they disappear into which layer. That has become so difficult. So that I was rather interested to know that how they go, where they vanish from, like they become, they show relief from Stramonium, but now nothing happens. The colds have come back.
It was hard to understand the whole question because of the sound, but as I understand it, she took Stramonium for a year. She was fantastic, no colds or anything, and then the Stramonium stopped acting. This, of course, I refer to in the chapter in the Stramonium book and the Map of Hierarchy, and the point I make is that nobody just needs Stramonium. There's no such thing as I took Stramonium and I've been healthy ever since. There's no such thing as a healthy Stramonium. Stramonium is a state you're in, and after that, you will need a different remedy. Now, that remedy will have a relationship to Stramonium. It's not a haphazard remedy, but it will be a healthier remedy. And if you sort of follow the process that I was just talking about, you'll see that a healthier remedy may be called for now, you know, a remedy like calcareous sulfur and so on. But, I mean, I can't prescribe for her over the phone or anything like that, but it's fantastic that she did great for a year with that remedy, and that now she doesn't need it, and the likelihood is that she's in a healthier state, and that by paying attention to the segment that she has now, especially to the main complaint, and then creating a cycle off of that, you'll be able to find a remedy, and the remedy will be a healthier remedy, a more robust remedy.
Great, Paul. Thank you again. Let me just make a couple of quick announcements before I let everybody thank Paul directly. Just to reiterate, Dr. Hirschke will be starting a course in Portland, Oregon, January 20th through the 22nd. And if you want more information, you can contact Kim or Amy at 413-256-5949. He'll also be doing a course in Florida starting December 9th through the 11th. It will be more focused, not exclusively, but it will incorporate more information relevant to veterinarian homeopaths, and it's the same contact information. And also wanted to mention the Herskew letter again, which you can either call or send an email inquiring more information about. Also wanted to mention, I know Allison's not on the phone tonight, Allison Burden from DHR Books, Whole Health Now Books, normally offers a discount on Paul's works when he does one of these teleconference calls. So if anybody's interested in acquiring the Stramonium book or either of the two Provings books or the Homeopathic Treatment of Children, these are all top-notch works in homeopathy, they can call toll-free at 866-599-5950.